Some expressions are able to capture complex ideas in few words. In only three words, integration through law managed to reduce one of the most complex narratives of European integration into a simple and aesthetic message. Put together, these three words tell us that integration is fundamentally a political process and that law is but one of the many instruments harnessed to achieve this objective. Now, we owe mostly Mauro Capelletti for introducing the expression integration through law in the lexicon of European studies. This was in the 1980s, in a research project conducted here at the UI, alongside the likes of a young doctoral researcher named Joseph Weiler. Since then, these three words, integration through law, have inspired volumes of literature and have defined how we understand the European Union, its legal system, and one of its most interesting actors.
À leur dernière réunion, les ministres de la justice de la Communauté européenne ont discuté de la compétence accrue de la Cour de justice européenne. Cette cour, la connaissez-vous?
Non. Non plus?
Non.
Tucked away in Luxembourg, as Eric Stein famously wrote, the Court of Justice of the European Union has played a decisive role in promoting European integration through the development of a very specific idea of European Union and of its law. This podcast is also about the court. Welcome to the first episode of Integration Through Pod. I'm Miguel Montedelgado. I'm a doctoral researcher at the Law Department of the European University Institute in Florence and one of the coordinators of the EU Law Working Group here at the UI. The EU Law Working Group is a researcher-led forum where the UI community gathers to discuss EU law. We're very lucky to have and host at the UI some of the most interesting researchers working on EU law, and we thought it was high time to share some of the action with the broader EU legal community. For our opening episode, we're very happy to host Morten Rasmussen, Associate Professor of the Saxo Institute, University of Copenhagen, and one of the leading academics conducting historical analysis of the EU legal order. Morten is at the UI conducting research at the Historical Archives of the European Union. His new book project is called, guess what, Integration Through Law, the History of the European Court of Justice, 1950-1993. But enough of introductions, let's get started.
La Cour va d'abord rendre un arrêt dans l'affaire C-345 de 95, République française contre Parlement européen. La Cour déclare et arrête, premièrement.
Okay, Morten, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. Could you tell us about your new book project?
Yeah, thank you very much, Miguel, for inviting me here. It's really a great pleasure to be part of this fairly new podcast series.
Absolutely new.
You're
absolutely
the first. I'm the first. I'm really honored to be the first here, I must say. And so it's a great pleasure. And also, I remember also my time as a student here at the UI myself. And I really can only endorse and say how good it is that you have these kind of initiatives from the student side. It gives another dynamic to the place. I think that your professors will appreciate, but also that, allows everybody to grow a little bit more as researchers. So, okay, but let me return to the book. As you know, and probably some of the listeners know, I've been working in the field of EU legal history, you can say, together with a couple of other scholars like Bill Davies, for example, or Ann Berger, for more than a decade now, and published in this field. And I'm also, during those years, from 2012, I think, to 2016, I had a collective research project in Copenhagen, where we had a group of researchers, which we, together with a network we built up of historians working with the topic, produced quite a sizable literature, I think there's only two monographs, but there are quite a number of articles published both in law journals and historical journals that has come out and deals with different aspects of the legal history of the EU, or not the EU, if you like, but the European Coal and Steel Community, a European community from 1950 to 1993. So the book project, in a way, is an attempt to bring together this literature, this research that has been done, also all the archives we have gone through at national level in private archives, European archives, and combine it with the new administrative archive of the Court of Justice that has only recently been available. And then the idea, in a way, is that you can finally write an institutional history of the Court of Justice. It should be mentioned when I promote the book here that we already have one monograph on the court in among the historians, and that is actually the book by Vera Fritz that came out after her PhD dissertation in Aix-en-Provence. And Vera didn't have access to the archive of the court, so she wrote it through collective biographies of the judges and advocate generals, and she did those not as a simple exercise of looking for public sources and writings of these judges and advocates, but going through all the European and national archives she could to identify material about them, to see behind-the-scenes talks about them, and thereby kind of recreating the biographies of these. And through that, she wrote a very good analysis of the role of the Court of Justice vis-à-vis the member states from 1950 to 1973. So in a way, this book is the second book, you could say, that will deal the court among historians. And the focus is to go from 1950 to 1993 and thus cover the entire, what could you call it maybe, the early phase of European legal integration, which ended with the formation of the European Union. So that's basically the idea, to write a properly archive-based history of the Court of Justice, as it was called back then, during that period, that kind of sums up the insights of historiography, add new archival material, and hopefully also, in the end, bring out a new interpretation and perspective on the Court of Justice.
All right. You described a bit the type of archives you want to dig in, the administrative archives of the court. Now, could you explain a bit what the administrative archives are and how they're different from, for instance, the dossier de procédure of the court?
You can say the court is split into two in terms of archives. One set of archives are indeed the court cases, of course, with quite, unfortunately, a bit of censorship on certain documents and without the délibéré, which the court do not want to share with us yet. And even though a lot of us have pressured the court, I think the best we can hope for at the moment is that they at least save the délibéré and do not deliberately destroy them. I think that's where we are, but I think under Cohn-Lehnert, it looks like we are saved. We have saved them, and they may be available in the future. The other part of the archive, or I should mention, by the way, that if you really want to dig into court cases based on these type of dossiers, the commission actually has the dossiers of court cases, and they are downloadable between 1950 and 1982 in the Historical Archive of the EU, and you can actually access material which is not censored and considerably richer than the court parallel. So in a sense, that means that the important part of the court archive is not so much the case dossiers, but actually the administrative archive. And the administrative archive is what the court has saved in terms of material from its internal administration. So what was going on in the court? How was it organized? You know, how did they decide what kind of clothes they should wear in the beginning of the court, for example? How did they run their economy? What kind of relationship did they have with national courts and other courts? What kind of relationships did they have with the European institutions? I think some of these questions, this material can help us. But I think I would be surprised if it's exceptionally rich. I think my impression is that it's important and it adds a new piece in the puzzle, but that without archives around it, it would still be, let's say, it would be hard to get the full story. And I'll tell you just one small detail here. When I started my research out in 2008 or so, I did an interview with Pierre Pescatore in Luxembourg, where I was looking for the court archive, which of course did more or less didn't exist. That was what I was told at the time. Or the president had it, and I would never get my hands on it. And only in 2016, of course, the court began opening its archive. So, but Pescatore, he told me, basically, when I asked him, so did the court kind of have any interaction with other institutions? Did it do any kind of diplomacy vis-a-vis the governments, etc.? He said, no, of course, there were hermetic kind of windows closed. There were no interaction. The court was separate, independent. And of course, what Vera Fritz showed, that was that during the Brussels Convention of 1968, when that was negotiated, there was a debate among member states whether the court would, there would be a preliminary reference mechanism where the court would be used. And member states wanted to limit that to high courts. So only national high courts could send preliminary references. And France in particular wanted to use it as a springboard to do the same inside the EEC, to control the Court of Justice. And there the court entered into a huge diplomatic offensive where court judges went to their friends among national ministers and in different member states and pressurized them to help the court and to, you know, protect the court, and did a lot of diplomatic exercises. And where do we find that material? In national archives, of course, where ministers suddenly meet Judge Pescatore or Judge Lecour, etc., etc. So you see, in a sense, the archival material, we can go a little bit behind the scene and sometimes discover quite a number of facts and, let's say, social relations and diplomacy going on that you would not be told about. Or maybe, as Pescatore basically said, oh, that didn't exist, of course. So.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Going a bit into the this movement that we are seeing, at least from the the community of lawyers, if we can do a separation between the community of lawyers and the community of historians. There seems to be a movement now of more historical research into the Court of Justice, into the European Union. Of course, into the court makes sense contextually considering this opening up of the archives, which was in 2017
that it was really open. Yeah, it was launched in 2016, actually, at a conference here at the EUI where I finished my collective project and Cole Lennartz and the court opened the archives at the same time. It was a little bit ironic in a way that the historians finished their work and then the court opens the archive, right. But that's how it was.
So do you feel that this is a gold rush now among historians, that everyone is coming to do this historical research? And is it a gold rush also in the sense that maybe the archives are a bit more dry than one would expect?
I think that requires, in a way, a little bit a complex question answer, because I think if there is a gold rush, it's among legal scholars in particular, and a little bit among political scientists, who now can get to the archives of the court, but also of the commission and the council much easier now, because so much has been digitalized. Dieter Slenker, the director of the Historical Archive, has done a great job also in providing a lot of archives of legal scholars, but also of the legal services, etc. I can tell you that some of these archives we have helped procure with the Copenhagen project and helped them to be submitted here so that they could be given access into a broader circle of researchers. So it's an ongoing project, you could say, among historians and the Historical Archive of the EU that really has, I think, borne fruit. So now there's much more material available, and I see scholars from other disciplines actually taking advantage of this, and that is fantastic, because we don't only need historians to use archives, they can actually be used by everybody, and they can be quite enlightening on a number of questions. With regard to the historians, there's less of a gold rush, because you can say you have already had the first generation of historians, where maybe you can say we were all young when it started, now we are getting older, but in the beginning there were only Ann Berger, Bill Davies, and myself. And then, because we had the Copenhagen project, because Vera Fritz got a doctoral grant in France, we suddenly had a group of, let's say, 10 historians, young historians, younger historians, and then increasingly middle-aged historians who worked on this. And most of these people have done their PhD. Some have left the academia, others have not. But the point is that, therefore, you know, a lot of the work, in a way, has been done. There are a few new historians coming out. There was recently a doctoral thesis defense in Oslo with a young German historian, Marla Lode, with a really a tremendous PhD that he had authored on the legal history of the EU. So it is coming, but I would say among the historians, it's rather gone down a little bit, the level of activity, compared to, let's say, 3-4 years ago.
Okay. One of the pieces that you wrote recently, which is published in the European Law Journal in 2019, you put forward this competing interpretation of the historical development of the European Union's legal order. And I found this piece particularly interesting because it challenges a lot of almost a mythological narrative that we have among lawyers accepted and practiced. And I'm talking about the narrative of the constitutionalization of the EU's legal order. And you describe it, and you put out, and you put forward evidence, very interesting evidence from the role of Eric Stein, for instance, and his this American scholar who put forward this interpretation of the legal order as a constitutional order, and his actual physical presence in the discussions that were happening in the legal service of the Commission during the Verhandlungslos procedure. Which is absolutely fascinating. So I would ask you if you could very briefly sum up how you think that historical analysis can contribute to a bit challenge this type of assumptions and dogmas in the EU legal order. And then a more provocative question, which is, do you think the EU legal community, the court, the academia, which play the big role in all of this, are ready for being called to lose their religion and let go of this myths?
Okay, those are two very interesting questions. I should say that the article that I co-wrote with Dorte Martinsen, of course, which you refer to, was in a way an attempt to interpret the entire history of European legal integration from 1950 to more or less today, in a way that corresponded to all these different empirical explorations that historians have done in articles and books over the last more than a decade. So in a way, it was an attempt of a gentle or, you know, historical interpretation. So you can say it's a little bit similar to when a political scientist launched a theory, except that this is perhaps, it's still generalized, there's still a clear argument, but it's not it doesn't have this kind of clear thrust that a theory have. It's more multicausal, built up by different contexts and different factors that at various times played a role to create that kind of development of European law. So that's the type of argument. I would say another thing that's important to know about the argument is really that we have gone to a lot of archival material in many countries, so that there's a whole lot of new documentation and a material that we have used to create and to write the history here. So qualitatively, empirically, this is new, and it's much more solid, it's much broader than any kind of empirical exploration that you have. I think the closest you can come may be Karen Alter's wonderful book on European supremacy in 2001, where she did a historical institutionalist analysis, but it was based on interviews, not archives. So, and a lot of public sources, right? So there is a little bit about what is the nature of the argument. So this is really what a historical interpretation is. It rests on this kind of empirical foundation. And therefore, I would argue that it's actually worth taking seriously. That does not mean that as a historian, you cannot kind of make mistakes or interpret things in the wrong way or in a biased way. You can always criticize an interpretation. But a lot of the empirical material that underlies it are not that easy to refute, I would say. So basically what I'm arguing, and what Dorte is arguing also, right, is that the old narrative of integration through law, which I ironically have used for my project title here for the book, but the old narrative of integration through law that was developed by Stein and Weiler and later reproduced also by political scientists in a way about thinking of how was European legal integration, how did it develop. That kind of narrative where the court is this motor of integration, where it's efficient, and actually member states and governments accept it more or less, and by the late 80s we have a constitution of Europe, hooray. That's basically the narrative, right? And, this is a podcast, so I'm saying it very quickly here. But in a way, it is saying that that narrative, which then underpins European legal scholars today's constitutional paradigm, that that interpretation of the history of European law is simply not correct anymore. It doesn't stand the type of empirical analysis historians have brought up. It also doesn't really work with a lot of sociological research that has come out. So we need to rethink how we understand the development of European law from 1950 to 1993. And that is, in a way, at the core of the article. So what we argue instead, in a way, is that, first of all, it did not end with a successful constitution in the early 1990s. So I'll start backwards. Actually, the Maastricht Treaty, the member state governments, rejected to codify the case law. They rejected to create a one-string constitutional treaty that the Delors Commission proposed. They created a union with three pillars, two of them were intergovernmental, and with the European Council at the center of power. So an intergovernmental union in many respects. So they created that, and high courts in member states, in Germany, in France, in Italy, they said, okay, now we have the internal market, which came in the mid-80s, we had to accept that the legal order works and it works, but your constitutional claim, we reject. You only exist because we delegated competences to you. I cannot see how that can be seen as a victory of the integration through law or the constitutional paradigm of the court, right? And then when you go back in history, what you see, in fact, is that the period from the early 60s to the 1990 were in fact a battle over a constitutional practice that the court launched together with the commission, but that was in a way a practice of interpreting European law in a constitutional mode, thinking about Europe in a constitutional mode, which was supported by the commission, the court, and the parliament. And it was also backed, as we could see from our research, by the new field of European legal scholarship. And those parties, they promoted this constitutional paradigm here and there and everywhere, actually, throughout that history. So if you look, for example, of all the different attempts to reform the community that didn't succeed before the Single European Act in 86, you see, for example, that a central tenet of all these proposals is that they're basically that the case law, the doctrines of the court should be codified as part of the reform. It's always the same story. And there was a whole battle over the nature of the acquis communautaire where member states said the court's case law is not part of it. There was a battle over that too. So you would see this constitutional practice of the supranational institutions being fought with between the member states, right? Some member states supported it, the smaller ones. The bigger ones were much more skeptical. And behind the scenes, everybody admitted that the court had gone too far, or very far. In the member states itself, a whole new picture emerges, and that is actually one of resistance, both from national administrations and national courts. And that goes for most of the member states, not a minority, but most of them, even some of the more pro-European ones. And it's only when the Single European Act comes in 1986 that national courts and administrations have to take European law more seriously, because now the internal market becomes the highest interest of the member states politically, right? Becomes high politics. So in a way, you have a very complex but different understanding of what we have called the constitutional battle in that period, and the fact that it didn't end with a constitutional settlement in 1993 in the Maastricht Treaty. The court betted on a proto-federal legal order and that a federal union would come, but they lost. So it's a different story in that sense.
Right. Okay. I think that answers perfectly the first part of my question.
Oh, and then the second question. Yes. Now it became such a long answer that it was hard to remember the second one. But of course, the second one, I think our legal scholars and other disciplines ready for it? I think they're ready for it. But of course, the nature of the interdisciplinarity here means that it's actually quite difficult to get a, let's say, a breakthrough of an interpretation like that. Probably, maybe the court book project here will have a better chance of that, right? If it becomes the first real overall history of the court during this period. At least I hope so. But I understand that. It's not a big concern of mine. You can do what you can. But when it comes to whether legal scholars are ready to take this in, I think many are, and many I've interacted with, have no serious problem in this. And I think we also need to kind of distinguish between two things here, which should not be mixed. One thing is that we can write a new history, a more conflictual history, about the emergence of European law, where maybe the old myth of Weiler and Stein, or the old interpretation of Weiler and Stein, who were very much parties of this supranational alliance that wanted to create a constitutional practice. Weiler has admitted so himself in publications recently. So they were very much part of that alliance, if you like, informally. And I think we have to distinguish between a new history and then the field of European law, where you create law, you think about European law, how it ought to be, and there you have a strong kind of basis in a constitutional interpretation of European law, and there's a sound reason for that, because the major court you study has had that interpretation since the early 1960s. And also, you have an interest in the rule of law, individual rights. These are key ideological kind of towers for legal scholars and for lawyers generally. So it's not so odd that, you know, some of these concerns are interesting for you and that a lot of lawyers think about them, write about them. And then you could say, lastly, it may be that the history of European law until 1993 was very much conflictual. And I think it still is today in some ways. I'll get back to that. But I think it's also fair for lawyers to think about the EU today. How do we ensure more rule of law? How do we make it work? Should we actually have new treaty reforms where we would create a more democratic Europe? And does that require, again, a constitutional, openly constitutional take on a Europe that now has so many competences, does so many things, but may lack some, let's say, transparency and democracy? So I think all these questions are fair. The history that I propose here does not necessarily undermine those. If it adds to it, it may add some reflections about, and it may add some understanding about, why the Court of Justice today is still has legitimacy problems, right? Why European law is perhaps still more contested than lawyers would hope it was. You know, lawyers' answer is typically more rights, maybe more democracy, right? That would be answers to legitimacy problems. But what if it's the European law itself that is illegitimate, right? Or the particular constitutional take of it. So I think there the history can maybe help nuance the understanding of the project itself a little bit.
No, absolutely. From the lawyer's perspective, it's very interesting to look at the application of the law before the Court of Justice in recent times, because as you know, the historical element of interpretation in EU law was something that was for a long period practically inexistent. When we look at the reasoning of the Court of Justice, it was simply not there. Of course, every EU lawyer starts as a national lawyer, and in national law schools, you learn the elements of interpretation of the law, this accepted legal methods that we see in the methodology of other international courts. So, for instance, the International Court of Justice gives quite some weight to the travaux préparatoires when it interprets treaties. And the court did not. And it was only very, very recently, on the top of my head, I can only think of the case, this Inuit case about the meaning of regulatory act in this last sentence in Article 263.4, this introduction of the Lisbon Treaty, very, very important provision. And the court actually, in the reasoning, cited the travaux préparatoires of the Constitutional Treaty. And it looked a bit to the intention of the framers of the treaties to construct the law and to develop the law. And this is very, very rare. At least I'm not aware of many, many examples Although by doing so, the court actually opens the door to parties before the court, having the expectation that the court will continue to apply this method of interpretation. There is this expectation of consistency. And I do think the work of the historians here are absolutely have a very, very important role in the interpretation of the sources, the historical sources at stake, and can give a very interesting contribution, especially even in, of course, in the meaning of Article 163.4, what is a regulatory act. This might be maybe a more technical issue than big discussions on the nature of the European Union law, of European Union law and of the EU legal order. But even when we think of fundamental questions that we're having before the court about how much uniform application should we have, how much space are we going to accord to national legal traditions, to national constitutional traditions, the national identity of member states, the national constitutional identity of member states. All these discussions are happening before the court, where the court has a very specific interpretation of the EU legal order and a very specific understanding of the historical nature of the EU legal order. And I do think that the work of historians here can come in and impose some self-reflection on the court. Now, is this an optimistic reading?
I think it's a Pandora's box for the court. Because there's a very good reason that the court has not engaged in looking at the travaux préparatoires. And that is that the Treaties of Rome negotiations led to an institutional and legal order blueprint that differs substantially from the legal revolution of Van Gendt and Lozenkoster. And I would argue, I've been working for quite a number of years with Anne Berger on a monograph, which is still unpublished, but where we have really went into depth with the negotiations of the Treaties of Rome. And I think we can say relatively safely now, with all the research we have done, that the blueprint of a particular institutional balance and legal order were actually relatively clearly formulated. And it was certainly not, you can say, along the lines of Van Gendt and Lozenkoster. If you like, if I should try to be very brief, you can say that the Treaties of Rome, in a sense, created a community with the Minister of Council at the centre as a legislating institution, with the Commission reduced from the high authority of the Coal and Steel Community, only to have the initiative, but also, of course, to take care of European perspective. And the negotiators did that in a way to find a balance inside the council so that you would not have coalitions of big states against small states, etc. So there were very subtle arguments about why it was designed like that. And then the idea was that the court and the parliament would more or less remain the same as the Coal and Steel Community. They wouldn't really develop, right? And there was also a clear view, and it was stated very clearly, this is not European public law. This is not going to be a constitution. It was, as the Luxembourg foreign minister sold it to the Luxembourg parliament, it was a community of international law. And so the idea was that, basically, national constitutional order should be untouched. So European law entered national constitution through national constitutional clauses of how international law would enter, right? Then the idea was that you had the council to legislate. So primary law, the treaties, were a catalogue of policy proposals, if you like. It was an agenda. The council would then legislate. National administrations would implement it. National courts would apply it in cooperation with the court. That was basically the system. So what the Court of Justice did, of course, was that it kind of changed a little bit through the preliminary reference mechanism. They used that to interfere with national courts and also not only interpretation of European law, but also how they would apply European law. That was, of course, a very unclear borderline, but it was there. So they kind of changed that. That was one step. And then they did, combined in Van Gendt and Costa, they actually took the power not only to make certain parts of the treaties with primary law having direct effect. So it wasn't the council that suddenly that would legislate. It was decided by the court itself what would have direct effect. And then they gave it primacy, which meant, as a combination, that the court took the power to define how European law would enter national constitutional orders, Michel Valbrook, a well-known legal scholar of European law and international law, he wrote privately after in 1964, after the judgment, to Eric Stein. He said, this is a scandal. If the court thinks that it actually has taken the power to decide how member states receive European law, it's going way beyond its jurisdiction. But that's what it did. And of course, there wasn't any kind of, you know, there wasn't any intervention to stop it. So in a way, you have this complete change there of the original treaties. So that's a very long story to return to your question, because the idea here is, of course, will that original sin, if you like, or deviation from the original blueprint, the last thing you want as a court is to go back to the travaux préparatoires. And that's why you would find, for example, Pierre Pescatore has written extensively. He was in the groupe de rédaction that created the treaty. So he wrote extensively of why there was such complex different views on almost everything in the treaties of Rome that it wouldn't make sense to go back. It would be too complex, right? So, but when I said all that, I would still say for the court, you know, who am I to advise the court? I'm not a lawyer, I'm a historian. But I would say I'm not so sure going back to, let's say, the travaux préparatoires or the primary law makes much sense. The court has made its choice. It's now inherent in the European project, for better or worse. I'm not going to give my view on that, but it's there. And it exists. It's what the European Union also is built on now. Now it's also codified in the Lisbon Treaty with the primacy appendix, right? It had to wait that long before member states would put it in an appendix, right? So,
and the reason why they did it was because they were the legal service of the Council was actually concerned that the fact that it was in the Constitutional Treaty but not in the Lisbon Treaty could force this a contrario argument that primacy would somehow have been derogated. So it was even a very legal concern of the Council Service.
Exactly, it was not a major political statement, right?
Exactly.
So so basically, you can say I don't think I would recommend the court mingling too much with that. And that connects to another question, which of course is originalism, because when you write this type of history, then you can often be accused by lawyers or misunderstood. That you actually say, okay, now I argue that the Treaties of Rome actually was quite different in its intention and with a different institutional and legal blueprint than what the court did at Van Gennen and Costa. So what does that imply? It means that we should kind of wipe the slate clean and forget about the way European law developed and we should need to go back to the original. But of course, for so many reasons, that would be absolutely senseless. Considering how complex an EU we have today, how many competences are there, how many policies are built on the legal order that we have. So to my mind, legal originalism in the American sense that we see in the US today makes so little sense in terms of that society and history develops. But the reason why historians are interested in these questions is that it's part of our habitus, if you like, or disciplinary kind of purpose, is really to write the most accurate history of how things evolved. And that's what we try to do. And of course, if things have a, let's say, a mixed past, to say it in a diplomatic way, that's what we will expose. That's just how it is. Why then, you could say, is it good for society? Of course, there the answer can be mixed, but I would still go and say that fundamentally, I think, we can build a better Europe based on truth, or let's say as close as we can get to some sort of historical truth, that it's better because then we don't have any blind spots, we don't have any myths. I think we can build a better Europe on that than on, let's say, hiding certain things away because they are problematic.
I think that's a great note to conclude. Martin, thank you so much for this interview and for starring in the first episode of Integration Through Pod. We did not coordinate in the title of the podcast, but thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a great place, an honor. Thank you.
And that was it for the first episode of Integration Through Pod. Thank you for listening. This episode was recorded at Villa Salviati in Florence, home of the UI's Law Department and also of the Historical Archives of the European Union. The episodes are recorded at the UI's Radio Cavallo studio, the UI's researchers' community very own radio station. We'll share a link in the description so that you can go and check some of Radio Kavlo's programming.